Couple quick things before we get started, because we've talked about soybean rust a couple of times today, and I'm not sure how this works in Indiana, because I have not checked. I am on the media committee for the state of Illinois, and how you will be informed about rust. Now, we had a discussion last year about how that should go. They denied my request, which was that as soon as it was sent to the University of Illinois, we ought to tell you that at least there was a rust potential sample that was sent there. And you can see what happens when the rumors go. I told them that the only reason we needed to do that was because it pushed the market, and you needed to know. Because while it's a rumor, factually it makes a difference in the marketplace. I was denied that request. So that this is the way it works in the state of Illinois, and it has some impact on how it has worked in Florida recently. In the state of Illinois, what will happen is if you find rust, you take it to the local extension office. The guys at the local extension office will take a digital photo of the leaf. They will put that into a database. The database sends that digital photo to five people in the state of Illinois. Four of them are on campus, and one of them is in Springfield. Whoever happens to be sitting at their desk at the time the email runs, and if you use email on high-speed internet access, you know that as soon as it's sent, it shows up on the other end. So whoever happens to be on the other end and sees it first will make a decision. Yes, this is potentially, or no, it's not. If they say yes, it is, that leaf sample then goes to the plant clinic at the University of Illinois. And by the way we've set out the way we've set out the rust plan in the state of Illinois, it has to be overnighted. Now, our hope is that it actually just shows up that day as opposed to the next day. So we could be in day two before we even get that plant sample to the U of I. Once it gets to the U of I, Nancy Paddocky at the plant clinic will make a decision as to whether this is Asian soybean rust or the other form of rust. My guess is Nancy, I haven't actually asked her this, but Nancy will know one way or the other. She cannot say, at least not the first time around. She has to overnight it at that point to Beltsville, Maryland, to the USDA lab. The USDA, so now we're in day three, right? And the guy that found it in the county down south is already sprayed, and the rumors are pushing the marketplace around, but we're in day three. So now we're in day three. In Beltsville, Maryland, they will make a determination as to whether it is Asian soybean rust or not. They will make a phone call back to the Illinois Department of Agriculture to Jim Larkin. Jim Larkin, because he's in the IDOA and everything is politics in Springfield, has to tell Chuck Hartke, who is the director of Ag in the state of Illinois, and he will make the official announcement that the first soybean rust has been found in the state of Illinois. That's the way the plan works in the state of Illinois. So from the time that it actually comes in the field, it could be as much as 3 days before we actually have an official confirmation. That's only on the first time around, and I was a little worried about this because when we got to Florida last week and we got the confirmation from Florida that, yes, they had Asian soybean rust, nobody really knew how we sort of knew how the process was supposed to work. Only the first official sample has to go to Beltsville, Maryland, from any state. Once that first sample has gone, at that point, that state's free to make the determination on their own. But it's the first one, and that probably is the one that's going to be the most important in states like Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, Ohio, Minnesota, South Dakota, where we have a lot of soybeans. So it could take a while, and I will try to stay as far into that as I can. Dean Malvick and some of the other folks on campus that will be seeing those samples come in may or may not tell me, depending on how much they think I'll gab. but I'll try... Right? Is that right, Steve? It's probably right, but we'll probably try to stay pretty close to what's happening with that. So I wanted to let you know how, at least in the state of Illinois, the Soybean Action Rust Plan works and how long it might take. And that I did, in fact, argue on your behalf that we needed to know to begin with and was told that that was not going to happen. Okay, the question on that was in our weekly, in the bulletin, which used to be called the Pest Management Crop Development Bulletin from U of I, that Kevin Steffi, Mike Gray, Dean Malvick, Emerson Napsiger, and the whole rest of the crew in the Crop Sciences Department delivered. The question was, can they talk about it? It would be Dean, who's the extension plant pathologist, Dean Malvick at the U of I, that would discuss that. I don't know whether Dean could. I don't know. The question whether Dean could tell you earlier or not. And I don't know the answer to that question. The answer for me is probably they won't tell me. And if I knew, they'd get really mad at me if I told you, but that's okay. If I could just tell you if it went from Champaign to Washington, I still think it makes a difference, and we'll take it up at some point with the rest of the folks in the state. But I wanted you to know how the Asian soybean rust mite notification would come through, and that at least in the states that have already had it, Louisiana, Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, Missouri, and there are 9 of them, those guys will be able to make that confirmation themselves, yes. What if a guy finds a sample at 5:50? About 6:15 the next morning, the crop dusters will be in. Yeah, I know. What? I don't know. Steve, are you still in the office at 5:15 on a Friday night? No, Steve's not going to be. Are you in Champaign County? No. Yeah, Steve's not going to be there. Yeah, it's probably going to work on a business day too, but with. You'll know how to get hold of somebody, and we'll get it done one way or the other. Okay. Yes, I opened a can of worms. Sorry, guys. No, I don't want to take up. That's okay. Well, this is the last thing of the day, so they'll get their whole hour one way or the other.
Counties having test plots so we can understand.
Do the counties have
the
U of I, I can't remember. There are sentinel plots that will be put out to watch for soybean rust, and USDA is in charge of that, but I have not talked to Dean since he came back from Brazil, and whether he was going to a second set of meetings in Indianapolis, Dean Malvick was. The first time around, they didn't have a plan for how they were going to put the sentinel plots out across the United States, but that was in the works, so they should have sentinel plots. They probably will be soybeans and other plants, other host plants, I would think. Yeah, okay, the question arose from Tennessee apparently is putting test plots out on their own. To the best of my knowledge, I can't answer that question. I don't know what Dean has in mind or what we're doing the rest of the way. Okay, are we ready to talk about corn? Okay, yeah, we're done with Russ. Let's do this. Okay, we're talking about corn for the afternoon. Most of the guys up here you probably should recognize, and we'll do the same thing with them that we did this morning. We'll let them talk 3 to 5 minutes, lay out a corn strategy and what their thoughts are about the corn market. Since you weren't here this morning, I'm not going to make you go first. I'll make you go last, which might, Brian, be the worst spot to be in, but we'll find out to begin with. Pete Manhart on the end down here is with us on Wednesday mornings. Is that right, Pete? Which morning are you? You're on Tuesday mornings. I don't talk to some of these guys. I don't talk to if I'm not. I'm only on in the afternoon, so I don't talk to some of the guys. Pete is on.
Maybe I just missed the day of the week. Some days I feel that way.
Today is actually that's why I've got this in front of me. This little schedule here. I can tell you which day I'm. Pete's on Tuesday mornings. Pete Manhart joins us every Tuesday morning on the pre-opening market report with Dave Dickey at 8:50 a.m. And then he's on Commodity Week from time to time with me on Saturday mornings. And Pete is here to talk about the corn market just a little bit. If you could lay it out for us very quickly, and then we'll move on down the line to Clayton Pope.
Happy to be here again. Paul Bates sends his regards. He's filling in for me today, by the way.
All right.
He's still around. Okay. Corn market, what can you say? We're going to be volatile again this year. I don't think we'll see the extremes of last year, but have a plan. Go with the plan. If the price gets close, don't cancel. We call that CIC in the morning at our office. But depending on acreage, are we going to have 1 million more acres, 2 million more acres? Who knows? Are we going to have a 160 again yield? Are we going to have a 130 yield? We could have anywhere from a 27% carryover down to a 6% carryover. We could have 600 million carryover up to over 3 billion, depending on the weather and the crop. I don't expect a crop like last year, but I didn't expect last year's either. Have a plan. Where are you going to sell? I don't like selling on zeros and fives. If last week you would add a bid in at 44, you might have got something done. At 45, you didn't. At 49, you might have got something done in April. At 50, you wouldn't have. But have a plan. Have numbers written down. Have something that's reasonable. I do expect the market to be volatile. I expect to have chances to market at higher prices than we are now. But it's not just going to be sitting going up. I expect it to go both directions. Have a plan, follow it, be not afraid to sell. You can sell crop and replace it on the board with calls or futures. You can sell futures and buy calls to protect against that. But there are ways, strategies to take care of making your marketing plans.
Thanks, Pete. Pete Manhart, of course, airs at 8:50 a.m. on Tuesday mornings. Next to him is Clayton Pope. Clayton joins us Wednesday morning at 8:50 a.m. as well. And he fills in from time to time for Sue Martin at 12:55 in the afternoon. Clayton Pope of Clayton Pope Commodities there in Champaign.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for coming out today. It's like a great crowd as usual. My comments on corn, I think, is so far corn in the last month or two when we've seen this spectacular bean rally, it's really been amazingly quiet. Like Pete said, I think we can certainly expect more volatility than what we've seen so far. I don't think there's any question that corn is just sort of dragging on the coattails of soybeans right now, but I think at some point that could change. Corn very definitely has its own set of supply-demand factors, both in the U.S. and in the world. The thing that jumps out at me the most, I think, is the world carryover. Everybody was so convinced was just so incredibly burdensome for beans, myself included, before this whole South American thing hit. But even after the South American damage has been inflicted, I'd say the world carryover in beans is going to be something like 90 or 100 days of usage. Corn is like about 68 or 66. I have my glasses on, I can tell you which. No. Anyway, 60-something days of usage of eggs in the car. But it's hell growing old, I'll tell you. No, but the fact is that the world carryover in corn, it seems like right now, it's funny, everybody looks at the corn market and says, it's hopeless. Look how weak it is. The beans have rallied and corn's only rallied 15 or 20 cents. But the fact is the fundamentals in corn, on a world basis anyway, are probably more promising than they are in beans. So I wouldn't really write it off just yet. However, that being said, I think the further we creep up in this December corn and look at, right now you have, you know, some decent values. After today, we finished maybe a penny higher. We're probably something like 7 cents from the recent high in December corn. At 240 area, I think there deserves some protection of prices. But I just would urge caution in the corn market. I'm talking something like 10 or 20% of what I'd want to protect at this point until we know some of these huge factors, which won't be long before we do have a pretty good handle on the acreage. But until at least that's out of the way, I'm kind of reluctant to jump out here and be a real aggressive seller in corn because, number one, the prices just aren't that great. And number two, like I said, I don't think the carryover, it's not obscenely bearish at this point like beans were a month ago, and look what happened to them.
Thanks, Clayton. Clayton Pope, you can hear Wednesday morning at 8:50. And then at 9:50, Paul Cooley, who's sitting next to him, is on with the opening market report and Dave Dickey. And then again in the afternoon at about 10 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. Paul Cooley was one of the people who helped design this service. I think we talk about this a little bit every year. But when Charles Lindy was the director of ag programming here back in 1984, I believe it was, Paul Cooley and Paul Bates and Daryl Good and Charlie sat down and had a discussion about what they thought farmers might like out of an agricultural radio service. And the service you have today is a brainchild of not only Paul but those other men, and they did a tremendous job. And, Paul, we thank you very much for putting that together.
Well, thank you.
Now, if you haven't noticed, I have more fun with Paul on the air than I do with most of the rest of the folks. But we've been around for a long time, Paul.
Had to retape the show, didn't we?
Yeah, Commodity Week, once in a while, I forgot to record the whole show and had to do it again. Only once we got to the end of the half hour, recorded the show, and I forgot to record it. And it was the best. You know, the amazing thing, the first time around, everybody got everything perfectly right, and if you'd followed everything, you made a lot of money. But the second time, they were a little off.
You know, I remember a Mr. Todd Gleason that had hair and was going to college, and now I know a very professional man by the name of Todd Gleason that does a lot of nice things with WILL and the Ag Extension. And, of course, Mr. Dave Dickey has done a wonderful job, and Jay Pierce and Ed Keezer and Jones here. She does a wonderful job, and it's a great privilege to be here at the Beef House. You know, in time, we'd like to talk about going to other parts of the states of Indiana and Illinois on an all-day outlook meeting, but that's down the road. couple of things. I'm going to talk a little faster than the group this morning because I know it's late in the day and you want to get out of here. But I do have some things copied down that I want to at least blurt out to you. You know, this dry weather that we had in South America was a lucky problem. A lot of farmers were holding a ton of corn and soybeans, and it didn't allow you to get a lot of corn and soybeans marketed here in the last 30 days. It even improved your revenue assurance programs, which is a big help as well. A lot of people are saying that, boy, this is, you know, we got high energy prices, and the next step is high commodity prices in corn and soybean and wheat. I'm a little bit backward. I think we're going to see a cost price squeeze, and unfortunately, it's going to cost you a lot more to plant an acre of corn, but I think you're going to get a lot less harvesting it in the future. Also, some of the people are out here yelling and screaming that we're going to have a wet spring. I think it's too early to come up with that wild guess. A couple of reasons why I'm a big advocate, even last year, and I'm repeating it this year, of more corn acres is cash rent. It doesn't make any sense to me if a guy writes down, I'm going to pay you $170, $80, $90, $200 an acre to plant soybeans on that ground. Rust is another issue where I think corn is going to play the game. The Indiana producer is basically telling me no change. And, of course, the farm program does encourage more corn acres on very productive ground. You know, this new ethanol plants are changing the corn marketplace in the Midwest in an enormous fashion. I'm convinced with these new modern ethanol plants, you could put it out in any parking lot in the United States, even New York City, and be a very competitive force in the marketplace. The South American farmer got caught carrying over a large portion of old crop soybeans. He got basically saved with this drought as well as far as moving old inventory and pricing and a pretty good new crop inventory of soybeans, even with this rust issue, and he's got a lot of corn to market. And then the other thing is my hunch is the corn's going to get planted. We're going to see at least 1 to 2 million acres more corn being planted. And sometime after the 4th of July, we're going to see the basis start eroding to where the basis levels are going to be enormously wide at harvest time 2005 this fall. So be careful with that little issue. And I think that people should be looking to sell 240 to 250 December futures. I think it's okay to buy 220 puts. And the Chinese had a press conference saying that they're not going to buy any wheat in the world. That's an indirect saying that there's going to be a lot of feed grains available at some very cheap prices in the coming months.
Thanks much, Paul. Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. Paul joins us on the closing market report and the opening market report every Wednesday. He mentioned a lot of folks. There's one other person that we ought to mention before we go on. You know, we talked about Wayne Nelson this morning. Wayne says he's the only person that's been here that's all 15 years. That is true. With one exception. Wayne's the only one who's been on stage all 15 years. Paul Winky, right here, who runs the board and makes sure that you can hear everything, has been here all 15 years. Give him a big hand. All right. Next to Paul Cooley is Mike Zuzula, who joins us every Friday on the closing mark report, the opening mark report. He's with Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, Indiana. Thanks for joining us today, Paul.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks, everybody, for the invitation. And it's really nice to be up here with the panel that we have. I admire all these fellows quite a bit. One of my clients had, I have to tell you this story, one of my clients told me the other day, he goes, you know, you have a nice radio face. I said, your commissions just went up. one of the things that I was asked more than once during the lunch hour was, I'd like to know more about commodity funds. I'd like to know more about how these folks work. And it's tough because they are a relatively new breed of cat. Some of the research we've done and some of the digging we've done, and we'll get into corn specifics, you know, in a few minutes, but wanted to touch on, they're a large group of people. Hedge funds are estimated, based upon some Financial Times numbers, are estimated to go from about $1 trillion in holdings to up to $5 to $8 trillion by 2008. So almost a quadrupling in size. Commodity funds are a portion of these hedge funds. The best we can tell right now is the three main avenues that commodity funds work is interest rate mindset, so Fed policy is very important, exchange rate mindset, inflationary mindset and technicals. And so you can see with the first three, between inflation, interest rates, and exchange rates, that's where you really see a confluence of the world economy and world GDP and strength of buying power. And that's where you kind of bring together what commodity funds do and what countries like China do in the standard, you know, economics of supply and demand. And much like Kurt was talking about this morning, we're hearing words like scarce resources, scarce raw materials. We're hearing the words like inflation again, much like the 1970s. And so that's really the trigger point of what we're dealing with in 2005. When you boil it down to the corn and wheat and bean prices, a large percentage of what the commodity funds are doing go back to what we're already studying, and that is exchange rates, interest rates, world GDP, and, you know, the world demand of these developing countries like China. That's on the hot plate right now, India right behind them. And so that's something to keep in mind. But right now, for instance, the commodity funds are net long in almost every commodity, from gold to silver to crude to grains, and they're net short in the interest-bearing instruments like the bonds. They're net short in 5, 10, and 30-year treasuries right now. Why is that? Well, because they're probably estimating treasuries to go down, and that would mean interest rates to go up. So Fed policy in the next 30 days is going to be very important, in our opinion, to where the dollar goes and to where these commodity funds go as far as holding on to these longs and grains or going ahead and shifting. Remember one last thing. The heart of scale-up selling is what we're talking about here. It's very hard to predict what these folks are going to do, and it's even harder to know what Greenspan's going to talk about or what the exchange rate market's going to do. So that's the meaning behind scale-up selling and not waiting for the top to be in. And the last thing is a small joke, and I'm a terrible joke teller, but I was in Fort Wayne, Indiana, about 2 months ago on the road, and I was picking up Will Radio like I was right next door. It was amazing. And there was a joke on there: how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? Just one, but the light bulb really has to want to change. And that's kind of how I look at scale-up selling right now, is that's really, you guys really have to want to change to scale-up sell.
All right, thank you, Mike. You can hear more from Mike Zuzulo every Friday on WILL. Next to him is Brian Maple of FC Stone. Brian, you're out of Indianapolis. Brian, right now I'm going to ask you, I want you to come over to Commodity Week sometime. Brian's the only one I've never talked to. I think maybe once in a while, if I'm filling in for Dave in the morning, which happens once every year and a half or so, I might end up talking to you. But I'd like you to come over and do Commodity Week with us sometime. So if you can make that trip over from Indianapolis, I know it's a long way, we'll make it worth your while. Brian Maple, you can hear every Monday morning when he talks with Dave Dickey on the pre-open Commodity Market Report.
Thanks, Todd, and thanks, Dave, and everybody for coming out here today. Thanks, WILL, for hosting something like this that I think is important, and it's very interesting to sit here with a panel of people that deal with this day in, day out to get everybody's ideas, and then you try and make your ideas out of that on what you want to do, how you want to step forward and market the commodities that you produce on your farms. I'm going to take what Mike said just a step further. It's very interesting this year to look at what the funds have done. I think probably almost any of us up here, if we would have told you that the funds were going to buy soybeans for 15 sessions in a row, basically 3 weeks in a row, we would have all told you that you were crazy. And that's exactly what's happened. They ended up covering roughly 135,000 contracts of corn through that move. And in the process, corn has only rallied roughly 15 to 20 cents. That should tell you something in trying to put together your plans from here. You look at recently, we've had some decent bean rallies, and corn's been up maybe a half cent, 1 cent. Certain days, the beans have been up 5-6 cents, and the corn's actually down 1 to 2 cents. That should begin to tell you something about what the trade is viewing today and what they're viewing is going to happen. When we get Thursday morning's report, I would think that the lion's share of us believe that we're going to see ending stocks increase to even that much more of a burdensome level. So that begins to develop my plans on what I think you should be doing on old crop corn, which I'm sure we'll get into here, and to some extent what I think you need to be looking at on new crop corn.
Paul Cooley, I have a question for you based on what you said earlier on. You talked about basis erosion going into the summer months and all the way into harvest. How wide do you think the basis will get?
You know, I think that... If we do raise a crop north of 145 bushels to the acre, I think there'll be corn put on the ground again. And whenever that occurs, the railroads are slower at shipping, the barge rate goes up, and the elevator has got to make some strategic deals about, you know, how empty do we get and how much space we corn we will put on the ground. My general impression is that the elevator probably didn't make much money putting corn on the ground this year. So my hunch is that it could go down in that 40 below. That sounds awful cold, Todd, but I think that we are looking at basis levels, at least at that level or wider, if we do have 145 bushel corn crop this coming year.
One other question on your opening comments, and you talked about ethanol just a little bit. Would you put $20,000 into a new ethanol plant? These guys are being asked to do that in a lot of places.
You know, these are very modern facilities, and you know, I think that a minimum investment is in order.
All right.
And particularly if we do two things, pass an energy bill in the U.S., and get states like Indiana and Illinois to have mandated usage of ethanol. You know, every time you pull into a gas station, have 3% and 4%. You know, Minnesota has 10. The Dakotas have some mandated usage. And, you know, it's a, you know, with this $50 a barrel fuel, you know, it's probably the sensible thing to do in the third place.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the corn market more. Pete, I want to talk with you just a bit about what your old crop strategy for corn that's left in the bin, unpriced. LDP has been taken somewhere between 28 and 36 cents.
I would be marketing that corn for to get some of the, like the July futures, sell it out there and get rid of it. I think that you can probably own it back cheaper later on. I do believe that we will have marketing chances available later, but having it still sitting around, if you've got very much of it, I'd be marketing it. I wouldn't want to take more than 25% of it with me into the summer. I'd want to market the rest of it by selling it out and getting some of that carry.
If the rest of the panel could take that on as well, are you right, where are you going to sell old crop?
Well, if you have taken the LDP like you described, yes. I'd be pretty tempted to be letting go of it on the strength we're seeing right now. I don't see a reason to hang on to it too much more. If you haven't taken the LDP, then why not hang on to it until closer to the bitter end when the LDP expiration is, I believe, May 31st. But at least that way you could see what the planning report beholds, and because you're really not risking anything holding it as long as you got the LDP. But if you have taken it, I'd be parting with it. I mean, you've got your hands full trying to market new crop at this point. We're coming into the time of the year when volatility is going to come surging back into these markets, and that's a two-edged sword. Sure, we could rally. If we rally, great, your new crop's going to be worth more. We could very easily break, and I think the time has come on old crop to get rid of it.
You know, I think we are looking at a growing carryover in corn, Todd, and as a result of that, I'd push the pencil and move the crane out, and I'd have a pretty orderly program. You know, if you are a basis player, there chances are, you know, around planting time is a historic time to push the button and get a little better basis. But I think flat price, you do have to scale up. And, you know, with some of you larger farmers, it's awfully hard to move a couple hundred thousand bushels of corn quick into the marketplace. But the big thing is you don't want to be caught carrying corn into the July, August, September time frame.
Very quickly, the two of you on old crop sales?
Yeah, you know, the key here is the March and the May spread, and with March going off on the 14th at a pretty, you know, big discount to the May, it would be our expectation that the May would follow and go down to where the March is, and that's a, you know, you're storing right now at this time of year for a rally, not for just holding your own, because you're starting to eat into storage and interest costs and condition.
And Brian?
I'll second that. The carry is out there in the marketplace today, even though I think May, July gets a little bit wider before it's over with. But the only way that you get the carry is by selling the carry. And I think you need to step out here very quickly and get the carry sold, because if this bean market falls apart and starts to dip, I think corn is going to very easily take that path right back down to where the Dease went off, where the March went off, and you're going to find nearby futures just continuing not to earn the carry that it shows you today. July corn today is at 220, thereabouts, 221. It gives you reasonable carry, and I'm going to back up what Paul said also. If you're holding corn in July, August this year, we're very concerned that we're going to have almost a double harvest coming at us, that farmers are going to carry corn way too long. All of a sudden, we're going to have to try and find a home for corn right as we're getting ready for new crop to come in at the same time, forcing basis levels to stay extremely wide for that time period of the year.
Okay, Brian, I want you to tell me about how big crop acreage for corn and what your expectations are in just a second, but I want to know two things. One, how many people, we asked this morning about beans. I don't want to know percentages, but how many of you have corn left in the bin to price? Holy smokes.
Todd,
I was kind of thinking that Brian might be wrong, but I didn't think I
have,
the, on the fact that there was not that much corn out there, but maybe there
have
is.
Less than 25% left. Less than 25% left to sell.
See, our opinion across the Midwest is the farmer has done a good job of moving beans into this rally, but has done a very poor job of moving corn. He's holding way too much corn, and we've got a lot of corn coming at us. On acreage, Todd, I guess it's been our feeling that we were going to see a 1.5 million increase in the corn acreage. We may have limited that to some extent with this bean rally here recently if it hangs on into planting season. But I don't see a major shift myself. Our guys over in Ohio and much of Indiana, I think Paul alluded to that, aren't indicating that they're going to make a major shift in acreage. The shift is going to come in some of the fringe areas that we'll see, and it may not necessarily be to corn.
Paul, tell me about acreage from your point of view.
My hunch is that we'll see 1 million acres plus, and it's, you know, Route 36 north in Illinois, and we're not picking up a big urgency to switch in Indiana.
Questions from the audience. If you've got a question, raise your hand. Yes. Price that you will start marketing new crop, and what percentage will you replace on paper? Who do you want to answer?
I'll go first. Right now, at this price level, 35% of anticipated production. The best thing that we can do for you today is lay out expectations of whether our expectations are met or not, and then you can continue on. Our expectations are we're going to follow a track like 2001 and 2002 December corn futures, where we have a high during this time period and then erode steadily into May, especially if there's no planting delays in corn. So we want to be able to take advantage of anywhere from a 20 to 30 cent break in prices between now and May. Again, it sounds bleak, but I think it goes back to you have to have expectations. And if you're wrong by that with the amount you're selling, and if the market goes back up through 248, which is a major resistance point, then you can start scale-up selling and improve that price. If that's the worst starting price we're at this year, we'll be very happy.
Last week when it was 244, 20-25%. But, no, I would be looking at 20-25% of it at these to nickel higher prices, unload it. I'd be looking at selling more as we got into the planting time, and I would be looking at if the price does start going up to you know, sell increments of that. But 20-25% of it right now.
Other questions out here? Just raise your hand or ask it out loud. What's the possibility of corn, and Darryl Good talks about this oftentimes, December contract goes to at least 270 once in its lifetime. That's already happened for the current one. Will it see it a second time is probably the question to ask.
I think we have a possibility of seeing it just based on weather. What is the acreage going to be? I heard down here 1 million, 1.5 million more acres of corn. 1 million more acres of corn at a 130 average yield, which could easily happen. You're looking at 280 corn. So I think it could happen, but I think you got to have some weather for it to happen. Usage worldwide is very good on corn. Ethanol usage is great. We aren't going to hit 2 billion next year, but we should hit 2 billion bushels the year after that of ethanol usage. That'll be more than exports. Let's get in there on that ethanol. Make them have 10% ethanol in Illinois and Indiana.
You talked about wheat market and the Chinese and saying they're not going to be in for the market anymore. What's that mean for the grain market for corn?
Well, you know, Dr. Tom Hieronymus always said if there was one bushel left over that's not being used either for exports or domestic milling, it becomes a feed grain. And whenever we have a feed grain, it's a competitor against corn and barley and other feed grains. So that's the fear, Todd. On the scale-up selling, you know, a couple of things that you do have some wonderful tools here, and is selling between 240 and 250, I think, is an area that you should be very, very alert on, is you do have some wonderful option strategies to take care of it, and also some crop insurance to help you too.
Let me go back and just pull, and I know some of you have given this already, but I'll pull you on new crop sales. Where do you start your and at what levels? And you can repeat, Pete, what you just done.
Well, last week we got to 244 in December corn. We had people start last week. We were trying to get them 20-25% sold on new crop corn. Now, that was on the board when the board was at 244, but it was from 240 to 44 a couple of days last week. This week it's been 34 to maybe 39. It hadn't been to 40 this week.
Clayton?
Well, as I said, in this area between here and 244, which is the recent high in the corn, in these corn, I'd be looking at getting to 20% sold. I'm kind of a contrarian, I think, on the acreage issue. I think there's a fairly decent chance that corn acreage is going to be unchanged or possibly even a bit lower. I think this bean rally is bought at least some bean acres, and I was never a real big believer in this, which at first was talked about like a 3 or 4 million acre switch from beans to corn. I don't think it was ever that much in the cards. But so let's just say it came out at unchanged or even a little bit lower on March 31st. I would think that would increase the chances for a little bit of pop in the corn market. On that pop some more, I could see myself getting to a third sold. But until we see that number, which maybe it'll be confirmed that it is a 1 or 2 acre increase, in which case I might jump and chase the market to get to a third. But at this point, until we know that number, I wouldn't go beyond 20%.
Paul, Thursday morning, World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates are due out. Anything in that particular report that you're watching?
Well, unfortunately, the bean panel this morning didn't mention this, but a lot of people are saying about 10 million to 20 million bushels smaller carryover on soybeans. My hunch is that we'll see larger carryovers of corn, and I don't have a good guess on the wheat.
Mike, let's pull you and Brian on your sales for new crop again.
Yeah, 35%. And, you know, we've got an option software program that helps figure out what options when you buy them, if the market goes a certain way within a 60 or 100-day time period, where you're on a head. If you bought a 230 Deese corn put and it went down to 210 Deese corn futures, and that put should be worth around 25 cents using standard volatility and not any increased volatility. By the same token, if you bought that put at 15 cents and Deese corn went up to 248 and tested that resistance level I was talking about, you're looking at roughly an 11-cent cost. So you're looking at a 4-cent to 5-cent, you know, move against you on a pretty sizable rally, one that would be very meaningful, we think, to the trade in the bigger picture. So you can work these options like you would the futures market, so you don't have to let them erode to zero, which a lot of people have said in the past they just don't like. But we're at 35% to answer your question.
Brian?
At today's price level, I'd probably use some put options because in many of the areas – today's price level doesn't give you much above loan rate, and I'm just not a real avid seller once you get down around loan rate for new crop cash prices. As you move above the 240 level, get into that 245 to 250, at 250 I'd want to have 25% of my crop sold at that point. Today I'm probably not real concerned about stepping out and buying any call options. I think you'll have better opportunities down the road. I think you've got to be extremely close watching how quickly we get this crop planted. If we get 80% of the crop planted in April this year, you better step up how much you're selling because it really adds to the odds for having above trend line yields.
Questions out here? Anybody? Let's talk about this just a little bit. And you mentioned it about the planting progress. Some have talked about a wet spring and slowing planting down. You mentioned that it'll make a big difference if we get into the field fairly quickly. And then there's the prospect that what if we do slow planting down a lot? Will acreage change at that point, or does it not matter so much because these guys can put corn in the ground in, I think, about 12 days across the nation or something like that anymore? Paul?
You know, historically, when we get that last week in May, people get the jitters a little bit, and you know that's when we really have to start worrying. My hunch is that Dan Bassey, you asked that question to him a couple of weeks ago, and he says, "Gee whiz, you know, with these new planters, you can get the whole corn belt planted in 10-12 days," and it just doesn't seem to be the worry. It's the fringe areas that we usually have to worry about, And but as a general rule, it's something we really shouldn't borrow or worry about until that time happens. And historically, every once in a while, you know, surprises do sneak in.
Where did the extra two and a half million acres of corn last year come from? And if we put that many extra acres in last year, where might they find another million acres this year to plant?
Well, they still come from wheat. In the eastern corn belt, wheat will be a chunk of it.
Because they didn't get the wheat in the ground last fall. But how many acres?
Well, we were down 4% in winter wheat acres.
So 2.4 million acres.
Yeah, you could do probably a million, million two on wheat.
Anybody not get their wheat from the south? Anybody not get wheat in last fall that's going into corn? Yeah, one, and it's going into corn? It'll be interesting to see how the wheat market plays out. I know those numbers came out, and I asked that for that reason, to see whether acres will actually get put into corn.
Todd, I got to bring up something here. You know, between you and Dave, you've got the ability to get emails from the listeners, too. Not only do you send out information, send in information on planning or problems or questions you want to ask on the radio, because the mic's open, isn't it?
It always is. Speaking of the mic being open, who's got a question that they want answered? Yes. Is there any sympathetic move in the corn if we end up with rust in the beans?
Well, beans went up, what, $1.20 or so, and it pulled corn 15 or 16. From what level is it pulled? If we have rust all of a sudden announced in central Illinois, et cetera, I think we could easily have a $50 up move just on attitude on rust. I think it could drag corn 15, 20 cents. Just because of that. But I think once you get past that, corn has to kind of stand on its own.
So we raised an 11.8 billion bushel corn crop last year, and we couldn't push corn down below, what, $1.91?
91.5.
91.5. We had 11.8 billion bushels. What happens if you raise the second largest corn crop in the nation's history at 10.5 billion bushels?
Well, we have
How high does it go? On a huge crop,
usage is projected at 11 to 11.1, so that would take carryout down. But carryout right now is 2 billion, and Thursday they might bring in at 2.2 to 3 billion.
We'd put overvalue on Dease corn without rust or commodity funds going further long at 260. With them coming in, you could go up to 275 for overvalue.
Todd, I got to bring up a point. You know, it was important, your question about just if beans go ape on rust, you know, how high is it going to go on corn? You know, one of the things where fortunes are made and is good trading, and one suggestion I have is that if you got a good corn crop and we get that corn acreage in there at, you know, 1.5 to 2 million more acres of corn, and the crop looks good and we do have rust, and corn runs up 10 to 15, 20 cents, and for some dumb reason like something called rust, you know, there's options, buy puts, you know, take advantage of the advantage, and the market's not going to give you too many opportunities to play the game over again, so take advantage of that, and that could be one of your biggest money-making plays of the year. So, you know, let the fire rage in the bean market, but take advantage of shorting the corn market on that kind of a strange move.
Yes. The question is about the farm program and the potential to have it changed on this crop. Of course, the Bush administration's 06 budget calling for a 5% cut in the farm program. I think that actually would be taking effect on this crop. Maybe the guys from NASC can
Todd, let's not even ask the group out here. How many feel that, you know, you'd ask it, you know how to do it, but these are some of the best guys in the world to get the answer from, and you can poll us too. You know, are we going to have a program change in the, you know, this year?
Actually, how many of you think that the current farm program, the one that's in place now, will be changed, and they will have they'll take the 5% cut on you? Anybody?
Yeah. Oh shoot.
Okay, now. With the WTO decision last week, how many think that your countercyclical payments will be taken away and that your crop payment cap will be lowered and that your LDP will drop back to, what, I don't know, 85% or something like that? Anybody?
Next
For 2007, for the 2007, how many think that all those things might happen because of the WTO this following year?
You know, one of the things that I got to jump in here, because, you know, politics are important for the farmer. And, you know, in the Wall Street Journal, it boiled down to this, that the southern farmer is worried about the northern congressmen and senators voting caps because of their big farmers get, you know, bigger caps of the $250,000 deal. The Midwest farmer, even crossing party aisle, is basically saying, look, it's unfair to change the farm program because the masses in the Midwest don't have that problem, and it's the smaller farmer that you're hurting. So it is an interesting battle. And, you know, one thing for sure is keep the phones ringing to your congressmen and senators to keep things the same, you know.
I'd like to say something on the spending thing. I think there's a feeling out there in general. I think the government wants to, you know, cut spending to the farm community, and you hear a lot of people say over the last few years, "Oh boy, I think the government's behind this rally. They, you know, they want to cut back on the LDPs. They'll do something to rally this market and get rid of the LDP." I don't really think that's the case. I think that we've seen very clearly from Washington that they want to spend, and they want to spend a lot. I mean, Bush has not vetoed a spending bill yet, which is unprecedented, except for one partial term president, I don't know, 50 or 70 years ago. I think that they are doing everything they can to inflate this economy, not to end inflation. With the level of debt we have, we have to inflate or die, so to speak. I mean, we've got to keep this thing going. And that's not lost on the bond market, like Mike pointed out. This bond market's been careening downwards, indicating higher interest rates. I think there's a stronger sense of inflation in the air than there has been in a long time. And I think that's in no small part due to the government's willingness and ability to try to pump liquidity into this economy. And I don't think they want to stop doing that in the farm economy. So sure, it might be politically necessary to cut some spending back and, you know, try to reduce the deficit where they can, make it more or less a token effort. But I think the bottom line is going to be they're doing everything they can to spend and to spend heavily to keep this inflation thing going, which I don't want to monopolize this, but we've all been talking about grain fundamentals. We're in a whole new era right now, I think, in the outside markets have never been meant more to grain prices than they do right now. We're seeing a resurgence of inflation. The CRB market's exploded. We've seen energies explode, precious metals explode. And that's definitely having an effect. I don't think that, I mean, there's no question that that's part of what this bean rally's been about. So inflation's in the air. I don't know if it's going to stay or not, but I think the government's doing what it can to stoke the fire.
It's going to help the farmer. Can we comment on that, please?
So the comment simply was, wouldn't it be a heck of a lot simpler just to put more ethanol plants on and not depend so much on foreign oil? And he would like comments from...
We need an energy policy passed by D.C., and we need an energy policy to include tons of ethanol, and we're on the way to building lots and lots more ethanol plants. But last year, you know what percentage of ethanol we used in the country in our vehicles? It was under 2%. Why don't we use 10%? We used, I think, 1.4 billion bushels of corn last year. If we'd actually get that mandated, like Minnesota does, that you must have 10% ethanol in every gallon of gas in Illinois, that would help. Those are things that we can help pass to get the ball rolling. But I think it's terrible, criminal, that we don't use ethanol here like other places do and use our own product, and heck with the Arabian oil.
The question is, does big oil have something to do with it trying to keep it out?
I think ethanol will really go once big oil decides to buy into ethanol.
The expert that I talked to a couple of weeks ago, and you may or may not have heard this feature story on the ethanol plant that they're building, that they plan to build in Lincoln, and one of the experts who is in the management of the production of putting these plants in place is from United Bioenergy. His last name is Krissick. I don't remember. Greg Krissick. I asked the question about the energy bill. He's concerned that if they push the energy bill through as it stands today with the 5 billion gallons that's supposed to be in place by 2012, that won't be enough, that we're already at 3.8, and we won't be long before we get to 5 billion gallons, and that if they leave it at that, it's simply not enough, and that big oil will say, well, that's what you mandated, we're good. And so then if you've got, instead of 84 plants online, you've got 104 plants online trying to put 5 billion gallons of ethanol out, you might have your ethanol plants might not be worth quite as much money as you think, depending on what big oil does and what the price of crude oil happens to do. And then the other thing is on the budget, and there are two different items. When you talk about farm policy, we're talking about 2007, which would be the new farm bill, and WTO's impact will have that. What happened last week on cotton, the decision, which is an appellate court decision, it happened last fall once already, and the United States said, hey, we think our cotton programs are okay to Brazil. Can you send it back to the appeals court at WTO? And the WTO appeals court said, no, Brazil was correct. You guys are manipulating the market with your export subsidies and other programs that were helping out the cotton and rice producers. That may very well have a huge impact, according to all of the policy experts. Bob Thompson is from the University of Illinois, on what happens in future farm bills. 2007 farm bill, probably not much impact on the 2002 farm bill, which is the one you're currently under. That one, when we talk about the 5% cuts, that one is in the Bush administration's budget proposal for fiscal year 2006. They have, and Mike and I were talking about this, whether it would take an act of Congress or not. They don't have to literally, I don't think this, and maybe, Steve, I don't know, maybe, Ayers, whether you know the answer to this or not. I don't think they have to open up the farm bill to make those changes. Now, it might take Congress to do it, but it's part of the budget, so it's the discretionary part of the farm bill. Yeah, they don't have to open it up, so they can take 5% out of your direct payments and then if they want to lower the cap from 350 to 250, which is the other part of one of the other portions of that, they could. So those could all happen in policy, and that leads me into what, Dave Dickey, and we'll get back to the corn or not, but
special programming
starting April the 7th on
First Thursday.
Yeah, first Thursday of the month. I think it's April the 7th. During the closing market report for the next 6 weeks, while you guys are in your tractor cabs, tune in to the closing market report at six after the hour like you normally do. We're going to go all the way to 3 o'clock, but the last 40 minutes we're going to spend on policy. And we're going to open the phone lines up so you can call in with your questions. And we're going to try to get those guys who are whispering in the ears of the senators and the congressmen and who really do the writing of the next farm bill on board with us to talk about how farm policy might change, and we want your input. So that'll be 6 weeks in a row on Thursday starting April the 7th. We're still furiously trying to figure out who's going to be on that program because nobody knows because the Congress, Larry Combest is gone and a few of the other folks that wrote the last farm bill are not there anymore. So we've got to try to figure out who it is exactly we need to have on air. But that starts on a Thursday, April the 7th. Okay, closing comments on corn. Why don't we start with you, Brian, and if you want to wrap up. Actually, any other questions on corn to begin with first? Yes. Cattle market. Anybody want to take that one on for the day? Mike?
Just a quick and dirty on that one. You know, Tyson and now Cargill are cutting back their supplies as far as what they're going to kill. We'd think that would tighten up quite a bit the already tight retail market. We look for heavier dress weights. We would suspect that there could be another run back up to the mid-90s in the front-end cattle futures, but we'd be hedging that area.
What difference does it make that the U.S. District Courts last week came out and decided that, well, yesterday they weren't going to be able to open the border to Canadian beef under 30, live imports of Canadian beef under 30 months of age?
We participated in a Dow Jones Newswire story that was pretty scathing of the United States end of this, and we have to stand by what we said because we feel passionate about it. To us, Todd, it's not so much the short-term implications because the market's tried to dial most of that in. It probably goes back to the longer-term implications of a North American beef alliance like we've had with Canada for over 100 years. Most of the Canadian people that are in our shoes in the livestock industry are saying, phooey on you folks, we're going to do it on our own and build our own packing plants, and we're not going to trust you folks anymore because of what you've done. And, you know, the difference between the United States in the last month and what really kind of ticked us off was when the circuit court judge made his decision, the Bush administration made their decision, And then the Congress came out and made their decision, and it looked like, who's running the ship here? Who's running the train? There's no engineer. And it just sends a bad signal across the airwaves to us, you know, as far as a trade mindset.
And I have one other question on this one. Is it a health issue or a trade issue?
Trade.
Bottom line, health issue or trade issue?
Trade.
Anybody else?
Trade Science issue? Is on the Canadian side. That's why we're taking that side. From what we know, we're no experts. We're not medical physicians. We aren't veterinarians. But from what we've seen, the science is on the side of the Canadians.
So, and Paul, I'm going to let you say this because I know. What would you have done long ago to solve this problem?
I'd had mandatory testing because it would have opened the doors up a lot sooner, and we would have had trade going on and a lot more money in our pocket.
One company offered to mandatory test all their animals because they sent all their stuff to Japan, and USD would not let them do it.
That's a precedent. Yeah. It's setting a precedent if they do that.
It was good. It was... And CBA and USDA agreed that it was set a bad precedent. I'm not agreeing or disagreeing, but that was the reason. All right. Anything else? All right. One other thing from me, and this is just on policy, something that I noticed over time, and because I've got young kids and I grew up as a TV generation. Have you seen The West Wing, Bill Maher, Boston Legal? I'm trying to think of others. There are a couple of others. There seems to be a concerted effort, and I tried to check this out in Hollywood but could not get an answer, that there's a pretty concerted effort out of television land against farm policy at this point. West Wing came out with a program. They've actually a couple of programs dialed in on what they called King Corn, and they were using ethanol. They were hard on it. Boston Legal nailed the cattlemen and NCBA and the cattle producers in particular on Mad Cow, and then they had Boston Legal was really tough. I called and tried to talk to them. The two guys that write those two shows, Boston Legal and West Wing, actually are pretty close friends. But they say they didn't talk to each other about what they were doing. Yes, I don't know that there's really any point to that other than. The policies that are impacting your back pocket are getting attention a lot of places other than in Illinois and Indiana and Iowa. And there are a lot of folks that are hearing about them, not from people like Dave Dickey and myself who are farm reporters, or in general, John Stossel's a news reporter too, but there are a lot of other places that are sending messages about farm programs, and it could be a rough ride ahead is my guess. You need to go after the people that sponsor those programs. I'm just calling and asking them questions, but I think probably you folks have to be proactive, and you've got phone, and most of you, a lot of you have email, and you can call and talk to your congressmen and your senators. You can call and talk to the sponsors of those programs and say, hey, look, that this is making a difference in my life. However you decide that is, it's not my job to make that decision. Yeah, Jackie.
When they look at an email, they don't consider an email to be, it's too simple to do. You know, and so if you're going to try and have an impact with those type of people, you need to sit down and handwrite a letter to them because they think of that as 5,000 votes, and that has an impact.
All right, so I'm going to make an assignment to Dave Dickey at the moment. Great, Dave. Dave, I just want you to put the addresses, and I don't care what you guys write. We're not telling what you write, but Dave will send the addresses out for senators in the state of Illinois. And the two ag committee congressmen, so their name may not be your congressman, but there's one from Illinois, Tim Johnson, who sits on the ag committee in the House, and then one from Indiana, who knows who he is, what's his name? Pence. Mike Pence. Yeah, Mike Pence in the state of Indiana. So we'll get those out in our email, and we'll put them up on our website. And then if you want to contact them about anything, at least you know where to go and get the information quickly. Final words up here.
He just said one word, proactive. In your marketing, instead of being reactive, be proactive. Have something down on paper. If you don't know how to use puts or calls or use the marketplace that way, talk to somebody that knows how. Everybody here has got lists of things that can help you make money that way. Your elevator man can help you make money that way. But have a plan. Have it written down. Have it in the proper places. I was at a meeting 6 months ago where a guy said he didn't know he could have an order at his local elevator in ahead of time, so he didn't get his $3 corn sold. Have it written down. Have it the place where it needs to be. If it looks like after a month it's not going to work, or 2 months or 3 months, it's not reasonable, hey, get something that is reasonable. But be proactive ahead of time, not reactive after the fact.
Thanks, Pete. Pete Manhart is with Bates Commodities. You can hear him on WILL every Tuesday morning. Clayton Pope of Clayton Pope Commodities.
The thing that jumps out at me is I would just urge people to be conservative. I think we have an awful lot of volatility ahead of us and more uncertainty than we've seen in a long time, not because of the usual factors as far as acreage and weather, though those are huge variables. But rust obviously is an issue, but these other factors I mentioned as well, inflation, market's expectations of whether inflation is going to increase or not, interest rates, exchange rates, and so forth. I mean, Buffett is making billions of dollars right now being short the dollar, and the dollar's barely moved. I mean, if this thing really caved in, it would probably be very bullish grain prices, and he's betting it will. So betting the dollar will cave in, that is. So I would urge conservatism. However, on the other hand, I think the ability is there, like Paul said, to construct some fantastic safety nets using options where you can protect a larger amount of bushels and ultimately be less exposed to risk than if you go there and step up aggressive cash grain sales. So I think the time has never been better to learn how to use these tools that are available to you, because I think this could be an excellent year where it could really pay off.
You can hear Clayton Pope at 8:50 every Wednesday morning. Paul Cooley is on Wednesday as well.
I think it would only be appropriate if I would ask Bob and Randall, two of the pioneers of the energy plant down in Palestine, Illinois. They were some of the dreamers that got it started. Raise your hand, Bob and Randall. You know, they helped create that, and they invited Dave Dickey and WILL to have a Outlook meeting down there. And, you know, what a way to pay tribute to the ethanol industry, to actually walk through the plant. And I think it's a wonderful idea, and I enjoyed this to no end, Todd.
Thank you very much, Paul. Yeah. Paul Cooley, you can hear on Wednesdays on the opening and the closing market report. Mike Zuzulo is on Fridays on the opening and closing market report.
That's right. Thanks a lot, folks, and we appreciate you coming out. It was a good turnout on a kind of a two other financial or other marketing aspects, kind of following up with what Clayton had talked about. We've got two complexes right now that are pretty close to major highs, crude oil and the S&P and the Dow Jones. Both are technically very overdone. Both of them fundamentally probably have a lot of risk premium in them already, especially, I can't say especially, both of them equally do. So we're going after bought puts in both of those complexes at this point. If you had to choose one over the other, if you have holdings, assets of securities and things like that, where a big break in the Dow or the S&P would hurt you, you could diversify out, and that'd probably be your first choice if you're going to do one or the other. But we feel like one of the two has got to break here, that they both can't keep going up at this rate without doing some major damage to the economy as a whole.
And Brian Maple of FC Stone & Company out of Indianapolis, Indiana, soon to be on Commodity Week.
And just following up on the ethanol real quickly, you were talking about new plants. There are 15 new plants under construction today. There are 22 more that are trying to get financing and 24 more that are in the planning stages. So we are growing ethanol very quickly. That'll add a lot of gallons of ethanol in just years to come, not too far down the road. So there is a lot still in the process. One thing you do have to keep in mind on ethanol, though, is we don't totally see that go away like we do in export of corn. There's a feed grain that continues to compete against that, against your corn in the feed market out here. And I think those are some things that are causing us to be burdensome this year. I think our feed numbers are a little bit too high. I think our exports today would indicate they're 100 million too high, that we're going to see that drop 100 million bushels. So we're burdensome on old crop stocks. If you're holding old crop stocks, you got to be quick to try and get those moved, and you don't want to be hanging on to them, moving them through the door in July and August.
new crop stocks, I think that you can be a little bit more patient out there to try and get some of those stocks moved. I think there will be, Clayton had indicated that there's some possibilities this market could fluctuate, and I think we typically will see that. I'm just not willing to take that risk reward on old crop stocks. What we talked about here late in this session was risk management in essence. When we look at Uncle Sam stepping away and pulling back some of the purse strings that he's allowed you to take over the past several years, I think you've got to step up to the trough and start to learn to use some of the tools that are out here. There are a tremendous amount of over-the-counter tools that are available to you today at many elevators. I think Paul ADM, I think, is doing several of these. Cargill is. I know facilities that are working with FC Stone are doing a number of these over-the-counter trades that you can get some stuff on cheaper, and then there's the regular board-traded options that you can trade.